It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 560 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here, SummerSlam Sunday, August 19, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. What a weekend it has been so far. It's not over yet, but there's been a lot going on here. If you are in the New York area, a lot of different wrestling shows, a lot of events, a lot of meetups. Yesterday, as I'm recording this, it's early Sunday morning here. We're going to get into SummerSlam predictions and all that jazz. But for me, my night started on Friday. As many of you know, I had the great pleasure of working with House of Glory, which is Amazing Red's promotion in Queens, for their biggest show of the year, High Intensity 7. It was a hell of a show, too. Amazing Red, after a full year as the HOG champion, lost his title in the main event to Anthony Gangone in a no-ropes match. And some people asked me, they said, you know, have you seen a no-ropes match before? And the only thing that really comes to mind for me, and they've had at least one no-ropes match previously, I know Anthony Gangone has, but the last no-ropes match I would have seen, and maybe the only other one, was probably that sumo match on Monday Night Raw. Back in 1993, would it be 93 or 94, I guess, between Earthquake and Yokozuna. The ironic thing, of course, being that Earthquake was a legit sumo in real life and Yokozuna was not. Kind of role reversal here on TV. But this was far more brutal than that match was, and I mean that in a good way. These two guys absolutely killed each other in this main event. Sasha Banks was backstage to watch Red's match. She trained with Red at the House of Glory School in Brooklyn 3 years ago. This was before her classic NXT TakeOver match that people still talk about in Brooklyn against Bayley for the championship. And she needed a ring to train in. Not that he, like, you know, brought her up and trained her, but, you know, that for that event, she was looking for a place to go and just train a workout before the match. And so she looked up Red. And if you look for it, you'll find there's a video that she did about it on WWE's own YouTube channel from a few years ago. And they show her at the House of Glory School. She's in there training with him and all the other students, working out, getting ready for her match. So she trained with him again last year at the HOG school. This year, she doesn't even have a match on the SummerSlam card, which is ridiculous, but she stopped by to check out part of the show as well, so that was very cool. Sami Callihan, a low-key, had a match on the show. Not their first match. I know they wrestled in AAW last year. This was for the House of Glory Crown Jewel Championship, which is currently held by Sami Callihan. Match was very good until the finish. A kick to the nuts, I'm sorry. It's rarely a satisfying finish. Unless, of course, it sets up a rematch, but it doesn't look like that's likely because Bully Ray made a surprise appearance after the match. He laid out Sami Callihan with a powerbomb, and it has since been announced that Bully Ray and Sami Callihan will meet at the October 5th House of Glory Extreme Warfare show, which will be back in Queens at the NYC Arena. So that's going to be pretty crazy stuff. Especially if some of the stuff on this show was any indication of how crazy it can get. We had Austin Aries defending his Impact World title in an open challenge, which was accepted by Ken Broadway. Ken Broadway has been a staple of the House of Glory roster for a while now. He came up short, but it was a good effort. I don't think anybody actually believed he was going to win the title, but I actually like this whole traveling champion deal that Aries is doing. It just feels very old school to me, very like old school NWA, so I like it. But the reason, you know, the reason I was invited was to participate in the pre-show, and it was JD from New York, it was myself, it was Ben Andijar, who's an announcer for the promotion. We had the chance on the pre-show to interview Sami Callihan. I asked him about the $5,000 fine that was levied against him by Impact officials for spitting on a referee Thursday night on Impact during his match with Phoenix. So we did that, talked to him for a few minutes. We interviewed Austin Aries as well about his pending open challenge. So those interviews, they're brief, but those interviews should be up on the House of Glory YouTube channel this week. Everybody was asking me, how can I see it? How can I see it? That stuff should be up on the YouTube channel in the next few days, possibly as early as Monday. And you should sub to their channel, by the way. They have a lot of really good, just slick, professional-looking content on there. JD has this series called Cutting Corners. It's a series of sit-down interviews that he does with the House of Glory talent. It's a great way, if you're interested in learning more, to get yourself acquainted with some of the personalities there. So you should definitely sub. But that's the place to go to check it out. I also had the chance, and this was really cool for me, I had the chance for the very first time to call a match, and it just so happened to be the Aries Open Challenge, which means that my very first commentary call was for an Impact Wrestling world title match. The irony of this, if you know my history with TNA going back many years on this show and all the rants and all the stories and all the garbage, it feels like a lifetime ago. But it is very ironic that of all the matches for me to call for the very first time, that it would be an Impact World title match. And now, you know, Impact now, it's under new management. They've got, I can't even say they have buzz. They really, that's one thing they're sorely lacking still. But they at least seem to have competent people now running the show there. And their television seems to have improved from what it used to be. So that's good. But still no less ironic. But I had a lot of fun doing it. I don't know when that's going to be posted. I don't know if that's going to be up on their YouTube channel or if that's going to be up on their... They have an on-demand service. So for like you know, a few bucks, you can subscribe and see some of the bigger matches and content from the promotion. It may pop up on there. I'm just not sure yet. Yeah, the toughest part of doing a three-man booth, and I mean, we see it every Monday night and every Tuesday night. And, you know, it's easy to shit on the announcers when, frankly, they're just very bad in some cases. That's just how it is. But the one thing I'll never shit on, it's not an easy thing. It really isn't. When you have, and it's one of the reasons that I'm not really a fan of you know, WWE, for example, feeling like they have to have a three-man booth for every single show. Because, A, I just don't think it's necessary, but B, you know, it could be tough. I mean, they're professionals. They know what they're doing. But when you have three, four, sometimes different voices, you know, the thing you got to watch out for and that, you know, you try to be careful of is that you're not kind of stepping all over the other person. So it really is not an easy thing to do. But I had a lot of fun doing it. Maybe one day, who knows, we'll get to do it again. Shout out to JD. He kills it on commentary for these House of Glory shows. Ben, it was great to meet him. Matthew Ryan Shapiro, their whole crew, great people. And a promotion, if you're in the Northeast, that you should absolutely check out. They've got a really impressive setup for their shows in that building. It's their building. It's their arena. They have the stage, the screens. The space itself is very big. They sold it out, or damn near sold it out. Over 2,500 people. So that's I'd call that a pretty good crowd. And it was cool to see a bunch of you guys also at the show, the ones who came up to me even before the meetup on Saturday. There were a bunch, I'd say maybe like a good dozen or so of you guys who I met at the show on Friday. And also Macho T. Got a shout out to Macho T. He was at the show. It was nice to hang out with him for a bit. He's got a great YouTube channel that you guys should check out. Our meetup yesterday could not have gone better. I want to thank everybody who came out. We had our big Sound Off group meetup yesterday before TakeOver. At the KBH, the King's Beer Hall, a few blocks away from the Barclays Center, we had a tremendous turnout. I don't know at our peak exactly what the number was. It was probably 100 or more. I know there were a shitload of people on the Facebook invite who said they were either coming or thinking about coming. It was like 140 or 150 people or something. But we had a great turnout. We got that great group photo we try to get every year. We had prize giveaways. Thank you to Julian Cannon for helping out with that. We had a three winners, some of whom are getting free t-shirts, and the grand prize winner getting a free copy of WWE 2K19 for the console of their choosing. If you are listening, if you did win yesterday, please make sure, if you have not already done so, that you get Julian your contact information and your address and he will get that stuff out to you ASAP. I got to thank everybody at the KBH. They were awesome to deal with. This is the third year in a row now that I've worked with them. We had the event there, and they reserved a whole bunch of tables for us. We had, you know, drink specials, all, you know, the whole kit and caboodle, the whole thing, and I can't thank them enough for all of their hospitality. And for all you crazy people who came out, some who I've seen before and some who I've never met until yesterday. And this is not confirmed, but Sam, I know Sam is listening. Thank you for coming out yesterday. She and I have talked. She actually brought this up to me last year, and we weren't able to do anything. But we're thinking what we might do, and this is in the early stages of development here, but we'd like to do some other meetup type event. And we know that this Evolution pay-per-view is coming. It's going to be in Long Island, but it's coming to the New York area. Basically, it's the weekend before Halloween. It's Halloween weekend. And so the pay-per-view is on Sunday the 28th. And so what we're kind of batting around is the possibility of doing a Halloween-themed meetup, costume-optional Halloween meetup that Saturday, October 27th, sometime in the afternoon or in the evening. I'm thinking, you know, to do it in the city, to do it somewhere in Manhattan, if not Brooklyn, would make sense. Because I don't know how many people the night before the pay-per-view would trek out to Long Island. I would not put you guys through that. Probably a lot easier to make your way into Manhattan, to be honest with you. So if you do think that that might be something that you would come out for, if you're going to be coming into town, if you are going to the Evolution pay-per-view, it's history in the making, you want to come and go to the event, and you'll be in town, or if you live around here, drop me a note, send me an email, tweet me, let me know if you think you might be interested, and we'll see. Maybe we'll be able to put something fun together. Speaking of, real quick, that all-women's Evolution pay-per-view in October, we now know the very first match that has been announced. It is official. WWE has made the announcement on their website. It will be Trish Stratus, the Hall of Famer, coming out of retirement to take on the reigning Raw Women's, and in my opinion, soon to be former, Raw Women's Champion, Alexa Bliss. Trish Stratus and Alexa Bliss, which is cool. Not the match I would have done. Disappointing. It really should be Sasha Banks, I think, in that spot. But maybe the match with Sasha is going to be with Lita, or maybe it's something with Bayley or with the Horsewomen or something. Maybe they must have some other big plan, I would hope, for Sasha Banks for that show, because she should be in a big match. But, you know, I just thought about Sasha and Trish, because they're, you know, big name from the past, big name from today. But if you remember in that Women's Royal Rumble match at the beginning of the year, there was a little interaction between Trish and Sasha. And actually, Trish even mocked Sasha's boss pose, which was one of the funnier moments of that Royal Rumble. So it would have been nice, I think, to see that expanded on at the Evolution pay-per-view. But who knows? Maybe one day. It just won't be in October, but maybe one day. Real quick here, got to plug Audible because Audible has been a great sponsor of this show for a very long time. I want you guys to do the following. I would like for you right now, wherever you are, if you're on your phone, if you're on your tablet, if you're on your laptop or your desktop, I want you to punch in audibletrial.com/solomonster. And that will take you to the Audible page. You can sign up for an account. You can try the service out for 30 days and not be billed. And as part of your trial, once you are officially signed up, you get one free audiobook of your choosing that you get to keep no matter what. So no matter what happens, if you cancel the trial, if you pay nothing, you get to keep your free book. They have a great selection of wrestling books up there. Trust me, the Daniel Bryan book is up there. Shawn Michaels has a book on there. Chris Jericho's second book, I believe, at least his second book is up there. Justin Roberts' book. Bob Holly's book, which I've praised before. Brock Lesnar has a friggin' book up there, for crying out loud. Hulk Hogan, do yourself a favor if you've been waiting, if you have not yet done so, or if you have and you want to give the link to somebody else, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Get yourself a free book on us. Also, thank you to everybody who made a PayPal donation. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this show. Just go to thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. Thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez. We haven't heard from Deadpool in a while. I don't even care, honestly, if he donates or not. I'm more concerned about him now because I haven't read his name out here in like 3 weeks. So hopefully, Deadpool James Herrera is okay. Chuck Lunatic Lentz, thank you very much as always. The Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T. Did I mention Luis? If I haven't, I'll mention him again. You get two shout-outs, Luis. Luis Hercules Hernandez, thank you. Dastardly Derek Smith. Bobby the Wizard Waldrop. Happy birthday to Bobby. It was good seeing you and catching up yesterday, and hopefully we'll get to do that again very soon. Downtown Kenny Brown. All these military trips that Kenny is being sent on. He's got the sound off with him. And he says, thank you for everything you do. I would turn that back around on you. Say thank you for everything that you do. I don't know why you're thanking me. The Belgian Brute, Nicholas Overmeer. The Sydney Brawler, Ben Hopson. He's got hops. The Show-Off, Corey Van Dam. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Jimmy the Mailman, Milstead. The Anarchist, Andrew Heller. Dark Sky, Dixon Krasinski. Andres, Rusty Nail, Nunez. Glory Hound Keith Doherty, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, and Mad as Hell Mason Williams. And also, shout out to one of our longtime listeners, Rob Francois, who just celebrated the birth of his first child, Addison Elizabeth Francois. He said it's the most amazing experience of his entire life. Really? I figure watching Monday Night Raw would be the most amazing experience. Well, it is amazing, just for a very different reason, but congratulations to Rob. Hopefully he and his family are doing very well. Now I'm going to talk about the Anvil. There's actually a lot of different things to get into. I'm just warning you right now. There's no mailbag this week. I just haven't had time. Plenty of questions, but no mailbag this week. I did watch Lucha Underground. I will not have time to review it. So there's a very select number of subjects we're going to try to run through here, including SummerSlam predictions, the death of Jim the Anvil Neidhart, which was a terrible thing. We'll talk about that. I am going to talk about the Dave Meltzer, Peyton Royce thing, even though I really don't want to, but I guess I kind of have to. And I'm going to talk about Hulk Hogan as well. So a lot to get into. But first, let's run through these SummerSlam predictions here before it gets too late. SummerSlam is tonight at the Barclays Center. They are back in Brooklyn. We have three matches that are set for the... Oh, and by the way, I was at the... How could I forget? I was at the NXT TakeOver show last night. And I will talk about that and give a full review of last night's TakeOver show. That's still to come a little bit later on. SummerSlam is tonight at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. We have three matches set for the kickoff show. Kickoff starts at 5 p.m., soon you're going to be waking up from your bender the night before, waking up at 11 a.m., and we're going to have to put our TV on to watch the beginning of these shows. They're getting earlier and earlier and earlier, it feels like. And how people like Asuka and Sasha Banks are left off the SummerSlam card is beyond me. I mean, I guess the world just needed that one extra Baron Corbin-Finn Balor match that we've all been dying to see. It's funny, the guys from the Gorilla Position podcast, they did a bunch of in-person interviews with different WWE talent, and they have an interview with Finn Balor up on their channel. And, you know, when he said this, it was partially tongue-in-cheek, but somebody took the clip and put it on Twitter. He asked Finn, so how are you feeling about your SummerSlam match here with Constable Baron Corbin? Are you excited? You have to see the answer that Balor gives. He gives the most unenthusiastic, oh yeah, I'm like, I don't think anybody could possibly look any less enthusiastic than he did talking about how excited he is for this match. He can hardly contain himself. Neither can all of us. But the kickoff has the B-Team defending their Raw Tag Team titles against the Revival. The B-Team beat the Revival, and they beat Matt Hardy and Bray Wyatt on Monday night, but the Revival had the match won. They had the match won with the Shatter Machine, not realizing that Curtis Axel had made a blind tag, and he promptly sent Scott Dawson out of the ring, stole the pin on Bray Wyatt, and so the Revival are getting their rematch here. The Revival, I'm picking the Revival. I think it's, you know, it's time to give them a shot, give them a run with the belts. The B-Team, it was a cute little thing. Okay, let's just be done with this. I'm going with the Revival to win the belts here. The Revival used the old heart attack finish from the Heart Foundation during that match on Monday as a tribute clearly, to Jim the Anvil Neidhart. And would you believe that there were people online giving them shit about not using it as a finish? There were people giving them grief and criticizing the fact that, oh, they used the heart attack as like a setup move or just like a transition move in a match. How disrespectful. You have to be fucking brain dead if you think that they did that for any reason other than to pay tribute to the Hart Foundation and that it was disrespectful in any way. It doesn't matter if it's at the beginning of the match, if it's at the middle of the match, or if it's at the end of the match. They have their own finish. They're not going to use somebody else's finish. They have their own. I thought it was nice. I thought it was very nice and very classy on their part to do that. And somehow people were able to find fault with it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Cedric Alexander defends the Cruiserweight Championship against Drew Gulak. Gulak earned this opportunity by winning a Fatal 4-Way a few weeks ago over Mustafa Ali, Hideo Itami, and TJP. I don't see Gulak being the one to take the title from Cedric, so I'm picking Alexander to retain. And we have Zelina Vega and Andrade Cien Almas taking on Rusev and Lana. Rusev has gone from the WWE Championship match last month to the kickoff show this month. But he is a babyface now, which I think is something that's been long overdue, so I'm happy about that at least. I have to think that Aiden English gets involved here in some way. And it can be, it could then be the impetus for a Rusev Aiden English program, which would kind of feel like a downgrade for Rusev, but they have to play the story out somehow. And Andrade then moves on to bigger things, which he absolutely should be doing. So I think Almas, frankly, should have a title around his waist by or before WrestleMania. That's my prediction. I'll make that a prediction. Almas will have gold around his waist no later than WrestleMania. But I'm picking him and Zelina here in this match. So then the main card starts at 7 p.m. We have Elias. He is going to have a segment on the show where he sings his greatest song. I don't know if that's better or worse than him having an actual match with Bobby Lashley. I'm sure we'll see Lashley. This is a very weird SummerSlam card, not just because of the people who are not on the card. And Asuka and Sasha are just two of many. I mean, you can go through a bunch of other names from Bobby Roode, who's been doing, whatever he's been doing lately with Mojo Rawley. But even stuff like Randy Orton not being inserted into the U.S. title match and making it a triple threat, kind of odd that they didn't do that. Odd that they didn't add Drew McIntyre to the IC title match, although I guess now we know why, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But there's a lot of people not actually wrestling on this show, and yet we have a pretty full card here. So I guess it's just a lot of talent, and they just don't have room and don't know what to do with everybody. And Bobby Lashley is another one here. He's been feuding with Elias now for weeks. You would think, well, this is building to a match. Nope. Nope. It's building to another Raw TV segment here on this pay-per-view. But Elias was originally supposed to have a concert at the Gramercy Theater in Manhattan, which I pass that on my way to work every single day. I didn't see his name on the marquee. But this was put together very late in the game. It was a very last-minute thing. They canceled it. They canceled it with the story being that WWE management wanted him instead to perform at SummerSlam, I guess on the grandest stage. I see reports online, people thinking, well, low ticket sales. Maybe, but, you know, it would not shock me, given how little notice there was for this, that they never even planned on really following through on this. I mean, I'm not basing this on anything anybody has said to me. I'm just saying it would not surprise me if we come to find out that there never really was going to be a concert. And the plan all along was to just announce this and, you know, we'll have to refund people's tickets, because people paid, so we'll have to give refunds and stuff, but just to sort of advance the gimmick and make him out to be a bigger deal. You know, I wouldn't be surprised by that at all. Finn Balor takes on Constable Baron Corbin. I am not a fan of this feud. They did have a really good match on TV a few weeks ago. Corbin is, you know, look, I think what they're doing here is similar to what they've been doing with Mojo Rawley and Bobby Roode. They're taking two guys in Balor and Roode who are more experienced, and they're having them work with younger guys on the roster that they have big plans for. They obviously see something in Mojo. They're trying to give him a push. Mojo has something. I don't know exactly what it is. Beyond, I mean, he's got charisma. But, you know, can he kind of turn that into the whole package where he becomes a really solid in-ring performer and puts the whole thing together? That's what they're trying to do. Silly me, I thought that's always what NXT was for, but I guess not. So they're trying to get him over, and they're using Rude as a way to do that. And I think that's what they've been doing here with Corbin. They said, look, we got to give Corbin some, you know, some good matches here. Who can we put him in there with that he can maybe learn from, or he can go out there and have kick-ass matches with? And Balor is a very good wrestler, so why not put the two of them together and see what happens? I just can't get excited about a Finn Balor-Baron Corbin feud. I don't care what their goal is here. My goal is just to sit down and watch the television show, and the television show, when they've been feuding now for all these weeks, has not been overly exciting for me. So I would hope that this is the end of their feud. This is a rematch of a rematch, and hopefully the climax of this feud, and hopefully Finn Balor goes over in the end. So I'm picking him to win. We have Carmella defending her SmackDown Women's Championship against Charlotte and Becky Lynch. The Becky Lynch story has been building for many months now. She has been on a very, or she was anyway, and I pointed this out, I think, back in June or early July, before it became the storyline that, hey, low-key here, Becky Lynch is on kind of a win streak. Even though she didn't win Money in the Bank, she's been winning a lot of her matches on TV. Then they finally started to draw attention to it, and it slowly built up to her earning herself a championship match. And then Charlotte came back, and they inserted her into the picture. And they obviously have a longer-term story in mind here with Charlotte and Becky. I don't know if there's a turn. I don't know if it just leads to a friendly one-on-one match at the Evolution pay-per-view, which I would suspect, whether somebody turns or not, that's probably where we're headed here. But we'll see. But, you know, my gut tells me here, my pick, that's why I'm picking Carmella. I am picking Carmella to retain. I know a lot of you are going to groan and grunt at that. She is not overly well-liked. There are a lot of people who cannot wait to see her stripped of this championship by somebody. I think that there is a story that they're going to be telling where Charlotte and Becky sort of cancel each other out. I don't know if one sort of leads the other to the losing fall, and it leads to dissension between them. It's building to something, and I think the end result here is that Carmella is the beneficiary. I think she ekes out a win, and she retains her championship, and she holds it for another month or two before she drops it. Braun Strowman puts his Money in the Bank contract on the line against Kevin Owens, with the stipulation that Strowman can lose the contract even if he loses the match by countout or disqualification. One idea for a finish to the main event that I have thought about, and I've seen this theory batted around by a few of you on my timeline as well, is for Kevin Owens to beat Braun Strowman. Somehow, some way, he will beat Braun. And I'm not making my prediction yet. I'm just putting this idea out there. He wins Money in the Bank. He cashes in on a victorious Roman Reigns after Roman beats Brock. And he wins the championship with an assist from Paul Heyman. So Heyman doesn't even have to turn on Lesnar, which I am still hoping that they don't do. Lesnar can just lose. And Roman wins, and then out comes Owens, and we end up with an Owens-Paul Heyman alliance, and they've got a stranglehold on the Universal title. Now, the critique there is, well, does Kevin Owens really even need Paul Heyman? What does he need Paul Heyman for? Kevin Owens can talk just fine. He doesn't need a mouthpiece. True, he doesn't, but neither did CM Punk. And that turned out to be a really fun, entertaining pairing, the two of them. Just because Paul Heyman would be most useful to somebody who isn't very good at speaking for themselves doesn't mean that they can't align him with someone who can, if the pairing makes sense. So I like that idea. That's just one of many ideas that have been pitched and that I was thinking about. I like the idea, but I still don't think Strowman is losing the briefcase. I'm picking Braun. I think Braun will win. I know, you know, poor Kevin Owens, he's been getting his ass kicked now for the last 3 months by this guy. Technically, in their last match, in that cage match, Kevin Owens won. He did win, right? He beat Braun Strowman. He hit the floor first. But, it's bad enough that they have not put the championship on Strowman yet, as over as he still is. They've had a lot of opportunities to do so. He still has yet to be the champion. To then turn around and screw him out of the contract, I think would be a mistake. And I also, and this is a minor thing here, but maybe it means something, They've already announced the match for Kevin Owens for that big Australian pay-per-view, and it is a pay-per-view now, in October. It's going to be Kevin Owens against John Cena. Now, of course, the card is subject to change. They could always change it, but that is the match right now. I don't see Kevin Owens winning the Universal title and going into the Australian show to defend against John Cena. I just don't see it. Now, all that being said, I have a little twist on a finish to the main event that I'll get into here in a second, but Braun, I think, is going to keep that briefcase, and that'll factor into the end of the show here. The New Day battle the Bludgeon Brothers for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. Tired as I am of seeing New Day always in the tag team title picture, I then see a match like the one they had a couple of weeks ago on TV with The Bar, and I am reminded of just how good these three really are. I am quite bored lately, to be honest, with the Bludgeon Brothers. I'd like to see them switch the belts back to New Day here. I'm picking New Day to win. But then have New Day either feud with The Bar or preferably a new team. You know, I feel like the Authors of Pain, honestly, could benefit from a roster switch. I don't know how you pull that off, but they could probably benefit from being moved over to SmackDown. Maybe there's a team in NXT. I don't know, you know, that Undisputed Era, obviously they're the tag champs down there. I don't know that they're ready to bring them up just yet. Although it wouldn't be the first time that they brought up somebody from NXT that was already a champion in NXT. Kevin Owens, when he was called up, I believe, was the NXT champion, and then he dropped the belt 2 months later. So it would not be unprecedented for them if they wanted to call up, let's say, the Undisputed Era, even though they have the tag belts. Adam Cole, of course, just lost his North American belt. They could do that. I just think we need new teams. They've got to find a way to freshen things up here. But, you know, some team like the Authors of Pain, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, they're such a great team. What great wrestlers they are. But they have something there. You know, they're not great, but they've been misused, and I think they could use a second chance on a different show. They could use a reset of sorts. We have Daniel Bryan taking on The Miz. This is one of the two matches I am most looking forward to on this show. This and the AJ Styles match. They aired three separate video packages for this match last Tuesday. Not even the Universal title match has three video packages for it, but this match does. They went all the way back to the very first season of NXT 8 years ago. The very first season of NXT when Bryan debuted as Miz's rookie. And then later when he beat Miz on Raw for the very first time, they had highlights of that. And they covered Bryan's retirement and the infamous Talking Smack segment where Bryan walked off the set when Miz told him he should quit and go wrestle in bingo halls if he's mad that WWE isn't going to clear him. And Bryan admitted he did want to leave. He actually did legit want to leave the company and go wrestle somewhere else, but he had made a commitment to Vince McMahon. He wanted to keep his word that he was going to finish out his contract. So then they had highlights of him being made the general manager of SmackDown, and of course they covered his return and Miz being drafted back to SmackDown. This is that rare match that has a year, you talk about long term, has a years long build to it. Not just a few weeks or even a couple of months. This match has a history that goes back almost a decade. You know all those matches they've done in the past? Like, I can remember them promoting the Last Man Standing match in 2004 at the Royal Rumble between Triple H and Shawn Michaels. And they built that thing up, oh, this is 10 years in the making. 10 years in the making. And I said, why do you do that? Like, I know 10 years is a nice round number and it sounds nice. It's 2004, okay? This feud does not go back to 1994. It doesn't go back to 1995 or even 1996. But they sort of exaggerate and what? And that's just one example of it. Here, it's not an exaggeration. These guys don't like each other going all the way back to 2010, which is 8 years, which is, if you want to stretch it, almost a decade. Legit, without any exaggeration. So that's how far back things go between these guys. And I think when Bryan came back and people think of fantasy matches for him, they automatically think of like great wrestlers. Oh, I can't wait to see him against Samoa Joe. I can't wait to see him against AJ Styles. Man, I can't wait to see him against Nakamura and Seth Rollins and even guys in NXT like Johnny Gargano and Ricochet. The Miz is not the most technically gifted guy they have on that roster, but he is probably the single best opponent right now for Daniel Bryan, and it's all because of the story that they have that goes back so long. And there was a time when nobody thought that match was going to happen. We didn't think Bryan was ever going to wrestle again in this company, right? And if it doesn't happen in WWE, it's not going to happen because Miz is not going anywhere. Miz is a lifer in that company. Bryan, though, I don't see Bryan. Bryan, I could see easily leaving and going and working somewhere else if you really, really wanted to. Miz, I can't see that. Miz is fully and completely a product of the WWE system. And he has done very well for himself there, and he's just one of those lifers. So we didn't think the match would happen. Now it is. Now, as far as the outcome of the match is concerned, and again, you know, when I talk about this being a big match and all that, I think it has a big match feel to it. It's not Hogan Warrior. It's not Austin Rock. I'm not trying to make it out to be something on that scale. But I do think it's a big match. Now, as far as the outcome of the match, it could hinge on his contract status. Now, Bryan says that he's 90% sure he's going to re-sign with the company. It could happen any week now. The holdup is that he's got a lawyer, which, you know, Vince McMahon doesn't like lawyers. He can't be too happy about that. But Bryan, for the very first time in his life, he says he's got a lawyer looking over the contract, looking over the fine print and the terms. And so that's sort of holding things up a little bit. But it sounds like it's almost a done deal. And I figured he was not going anywhere, especially once they announced that showcase mode for the new video game is based around him. I figured, all right, well, this is basically a done deal at this point. I think Miz is winning this match regardless of whether he stays or leaves. I don't even think it matters at this point. I think it would be better to have Miz win to keep the feud going and make people want to see Bryan beat his ass even more. You know, so I also think that we see the wives get involved in this match. I think they'll be there, maybe ringside, sitting in the crowd or something. But I think Maryse and Brie, I have a feeling Maryse and Brie are in some way, shape, or form going to end up getting involved in this match. But believe me, this is not the end of this feud. Jeff Hardy challenges Shinsuke Nakamura for the United States Championship. I said it before, I'm surprised they didn't add Orton to make it a triple threat, but safe to say that he will probably be involved here in some way. But, you know, again, his beef is with Hardy. His mission is to destroy all those who the fans like. And so I think he costs Hardy the match, and Nakamura retains. Dolph Ziggler defends the Intercontinental title against Seth Rollins. Last Monday, we saw the return of the game. The King of Kings. The Cerebral Assassin. Dean Ambrose on TV after 8 months away, recovering from a triceps tear. Rollins introduced him as his backup for tonight's match to combat Drew McIntyre, who will be standing in Dolph Ziggler's corner because, of course, the best role for Drew McIntyre is standing in the corner on your second biggest show of the year. But I digress. But Ambrose came out on Monday night. He was looking good, man. He looked jacked. He got a new buzz cut, heel, beard. He's looking like a guy who was just released from prison and is still pretty pissed off about it. And yes, he did look a lot like Triple H. So what we have, and actually so does Ziggler, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't know what the hell he's doing. He straightened his hair. Ziggler comes out there. He's looking like 2002 Reign of Terror Triple H out there. I think clearly these guys have figured out that flattery is the best way to get over. But you know, it's good to see Ambrose back and not his wacky Dean. I'm done with wacky Dean Ambrose. I'm ready for, you know, don't drop the soap, prison Ambrose. I'm ready for that. I think the heel turn is coming. I don't think it happens tonight. I don't think it happens at SummerSlam. Instead, I think he helps combat Drew, and I think he helps Seth win the championship. I think Rollins regains the IC title tonight, only then for tomorrow night on Raw for Ambrose to turn on him. So I think the turn is coming. I just think they're going to save it for Monday and not do it tonight. And then that sets up your next title feud for the Intercontinental title. And with Ziggler losing, I think, and depending on how the loss goes down, maybe it's a miscommunication, maybe McIntyre hits a Claymore kick and accidentally kicks Ziggler. However it goes down, I think that begins to, it's sort of the first crack in the armor between him and McIntyre, which leads to an eventual split. And I say eventual, meaning maybe not this week, but very soon. They'll split the two of them up, and McIntyre can sort of go off on his own, finally. But that's clearly where all roads, I think, are leading between those two. And once Ziggler loses that title, I don't know that he has much incentive, really, to McIntyre, that is, to protect him anymore. So maybe it's just a matter of Ziggler loses. He's a loser, and, you know, it's sort of baggage that McIntyre feels he doesn't need, and he branches off on his own. But that's how I see things playing out. By the way, on his podcast, Chris Jericho claims that he pitched the idea to WWE management for an IC champion versus IC champion match, pitting himself against Seth Rollins back when Rollins was still the IC champion. He claims that the company was receptive to the idea. They were, you know, they listened to it and they were, I guess, considering it. In his mind, they were maybe considering it. And then nobody called him back. And he said his idea was that the match would end in a DQ, because you can't have a clear winner, one way or the other, obviously. But it would end in a DQ with whoever was going to challenge Seth next for his title coming out and interfering. And that was the idea that he came up with. And this is actually not the first time that idea has been pitched. It was 3 years ago, if you remember. Daniel Bryan pitched the exact same idea for an Intercontinental Champion versus Intercontinental Champion match, WWE versus New Japan, pitting himself against Shinsuke Nakamura. He said that they could even simulcast it. They could simulcast it on New Japan World and the WWE Network. You know, and I'm sure after Vince McMahon at the time said, "Who is Nakamura?" and everybody laughed, it was probably never spoken of again. But that would have been a pretty cool idea. So, after this MSG sellout with Ring of Honor and New Japan, I doubt that WWE is going to be very receptive to doing much of anything with New Japan. Ronda Rousey takes on Alexa Bliss for the Raw Women's title. Ronda had a close encounter with Batman on Monday night. He got a little too close for comfort. Yes, a fucking bat somehow got into the building and wanted a ringside seat during the opening match on Monday with Alexa Bliss and Ember Moon. Ronda was ringside cheering on Ember when the bat flew right next to her. You could see her get all freaked out and say, "Oh my God, it's a bat." Or whether it was like, "Oh my God, that's a bat." Which is more than what I would probably be able to say in a situation like that. The only words out of my mouth would be, "Oh shit." And I would be that guy sprinting through the crowd, up the concourse, out the exit door, and into an Uber on my way to the airport to get me as far away as possible. But that's me. Natty, obviously, is still mourning her father's death. I don't know if she will be at the show tonight in Rousey's corner. Whether she is or she isn't, I've been saying for months that they've been waiting for that one moment where Ronda Rousey takes Alexa Bliss by the arm and breaks her arm. And Alexa does the trick where the arm comes out of the socket and it looks all nasty and gnarly, and they probably get a great visual for a SportsCenter moment out of it. Because, well, most people, if they watch a show like SportsCenter and they hear that Ronda Rousey broke this poor girl's arm and they see her arm all twisted up to shit, you know, they don't know that this girl is double jointed or whatever. They're just looking at it going, "Ooh, that's nasty." So I think that's the moment they're going for. That should be the moment they're going for here. I think Ronda should win. I think she will win. She is my pick to win her first championship here. And then they can build to Ronda and Natty at the Evolution show in October. And it's a similar situation as to Charlotte and Becky. You could have one turn on the other out of jealousy, but you don't even have to. There doesn't have to be a turn. You don't have to go turn crazy. It could be a friendly competition. Maybe that leads to dissension between them. But whether one goes heel or not, I think that would be the obvious match to shoot for, would be Natty and Ronda for the championship, probably in October at that show. It's probably very likely going to be champion versus champion. If I had to venture a guess here at WrestleMania next year, Ronda as the Raw Women's Champion facing Charlotte as the SmackDown Women's Champion. But I don't think this match here should go very long. The less selling Ronda has to do for Alexa Bliss, the better. Although Bliss now is having a match with Trish Stratus in a couple of months, so maybe they want to keep her looking strong. And I think back to WrestleMania, though, when they had Nia Jax for like 8 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever it was selling for Alexa Bliss, which was quite ridiculous. So we'll see, but Ronda should go over here. We have AJ Styles defending the WWE Championship against Samoa Joe. This is the other match I'm really looking forward to the most. The build-up here has been very simple. Joe has made it personal. He has brought up AJ's family and said that AJ is married to the road more than he is his own wife. He doesn't care about his kids. Every time he comes out here and talks about how he's away from home and his wife is basically a single parent, all that means is that AJ doesn't care about them. So, yeah, they've been making this personal. And then on Tuesday, Joe comes out dressed up in a suit, and he's got a letter in his hand. Now, earlier in the show, AJ had name-dropped his wife. His wife's name is Wendy, and so he had already mentioned this. He planted that seed. Joe comes out. He says, I have a letter in my hand. I have a letter in my hand here from your biggest fan, or formerly your biggest fan. This person is no longer your biggest fan. And the gist of it is that, you know, the fan, quote-unquote, believes that AJ never really wanted to get married. He never really wanted to have any kids. He's such a great champion because he'll do anything to stay away from his family. Now, I thought what was odd about this is AJ didn't really get angry. He almost had like a smile, like he was laughing. As this went on, you would think, especially once they got to the punchline at the end, I expected him to just bolt out of the ring after Joe, and he never did. So I thought that was kind of weird. If that were me, if I were in his shoes and somebody said that about my wife or my family, that's the first thing I would do. But anyway, the letter goes on here. The fan hopes that Joe wins at SummerSlam so that AJ can know what it feels like to lose the thing he cares the most about, because this fan lost him a long time ago. And he says the letter is signed Wendy Styles. I so wish that Joe would have just said the letter was from a random fan signed by a woman named Claire. I know less than maybe 1,000 people, if that, watching the show would have even gotten that reference. But fuck, that would have been fantastic. That would have been fantastic. Maybe she'll be front row. Maybe she'll be at the Barclays Center tonight. Claire Lynch. She'll be ringside. So anyway, we have come to a point, I feel like, where the championship should come off of AJ. He's been champion now for a very long time. I guess going back to November of last year when he beat Jinder Mahal, right before he had that excellent match with Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, or Survivor Series, rather. But I think the time has come. And not only has the time come for him to lose the championship and chase it for a change, but I think Joe is more than deserving of getting a run with the belt. He's been sidelined at the most, you know, shittiest of times by freak injuries. I mean, look at what happened to him this year. He missed WrestleMania because he was wrestling Titus O'Neil. And his heel popped or something, some weird foot injury, the way he planted his foot or something. I mean, it was crazy. But he's healthy now, and his promos have always been excellent. I mean, Joe can he's probably the best talker in the company. I mean, you could say Heyman, I guess, but Heyman's not around enough, I think, to really justify that title. I would say Joe is the best talker they have in the company right now, in terms of full-time talent anyway. Joe deserves a run with the belt. AJ could chase him. They could have another one or two matches after this. I think it's time. And I'm going with Samoa Joe to win the championship. And finally, speak of the devil, Brock Lesnar defends the Universal title against Roman Reigns. There was an article on Yahoo Sports this week. I'm sure many of you saw this, and those of you who haven't will love this. There was an article on Yahoo with the headline, Why Roman Reigns is the Champion WWE Fans Don't Realize They Truly Need. And in the article, there is a quote from Roman where he refers to all of his haters as actually being closet lovers of his. They are more connected, he says. They are more connected to me than their so-called favorites. So that should please the fans tonight at the Barclays Center, the ones who read that interview. I thought that was quite the quote. Last Monday, Paul Heyman showed up on Raw. He confronted Roman Reigns. He name-dropped the Usos. He called them the future of the tag team division, which was an odd statement to make given that the Usos have been around the tag team division now for 8 years. That's like WWE building the Rock Hogan match at WrestleMania 18 around this idea of wrestling's past against wrestling's future. And by that point, Rock was mostly done as a full-time performer. So anyway, very odd. But he was setting up to put Reigns over here in this promo, and he said, look, you know, he made an offer to him. He said, I could give away all of Brock Lesnar's secrets. He put his hand out for Roman to shake it. Of course, he didn't. Heyman offered his services to him. He talked about riding with Afa and Sika back in the day, Sika, of course, being Roman's father. And this is not the first time that Heyman has brought up Sika's name. He did so many years ago before their first match, I believe, at WrestleMania 31. It might have actually been when they had the Raw episode that got snowed out. And they had to improvise, and they had a series of interviews at the WWE headquarters, at their studios. And that might have been the first time that I can remember Heyman really bringing up and talking about the Samoan bloodline and, you know, your father and all of that stuff. And so that goes back, you know, 3.5 years at this point. And I think that's important to keep in mind here, because Heyman then said something to Roman in Samoan. And I wish I would dust off my Samoan so I could translate for you, but I have forgotten everything I have learned in the past about the language. But he said something to him in Samoan. Reigns seemed like he was taken aback by this. Perhaps it was just the fact that Paul Heyman actually knew how to say something in Samoan. Maybe that's why he had that dumb look on his face. But Heyman handed him a piece of paper. He said, look, you don't have to give me an answer until Sunday. And at that point, Roman kind of opened the letter. He was looking at it. And Heyman pulled out a can of pepper spray. And he sprayed Reigns in the eyes. Now, I was intrigued by this little twist. Until Heyman pulled out the pepper spray and basically maced him in the face. Brock Lesnar came out. Roman now is completely blinded. He puts Reigns out with a guillotine choke. Comes back to the ring, gives him an F5, lays him out. I know some of you like this. It wasn't bad, but I thought they killed a lot of the intrigue around this match once Heyman exposed that it was all just a setup. Now, maybe it's all going to make sense after tonight why they did what they did the way they did it, but when this segment was over, I was disappointed. I thought they should have let it linger until tonight. What was in the letter? What's Roman going to do? Eh, he's not going to go with Heyman, but you know, maybe he will. What's in that letter? We still don't know what was in that letter. It is still possible that we might find out, or it could be completely forgotten about, but there is still the possibility we will find out what was in there. Now, there's so many different ways that this could go down. Brock could just win and keep the title until WrestleMania just to piss everybody off. That would be the worst outcome here. Roman could just win the championship straight up and get the big pyro and confetti celebration in Brooklyn, which would also be pretty underwhelming at this point. But I'm of the mind at this point, just fucking get it over with already. It's like they just tease it and tease it and, oh, we're going to do it. And then, oh, Vince changes his mind. And like, just do it already. If you're going to do it, just do it. I don't know why you have to drag this out for so long. So that's one possibility. We have the possibility that Heyman could turn on Brock Lesnar and could go with Roman Reigns after all. Roman could win the title and everybody's all upset. And then, you know, Braun Strowman could come out to cash in Money in the Bank. And maybe Heyman even aligns with Braun Strowman and goes with him. Maybe Kevin Owens does win the briefcase and cashes in on Reigns and aligns with Heyman, like I said earlier. There's a lot of different possibilities here. Here's the idea that I like the most. And shout out to Donnie, actually, on Twitter, one of our listeners, because he had the same idea. And I think it's a really good one. I would put the chances of it happening at less than 50%, probably a lot less than 50%. But here it is. And I think the seeds have been planted for this already. I think that Reigns finally slays the beast and wins the championship. So I'm picking Roman to win here, okay? Now, that's not my big idea, okay? I also think that Braun Strowman, he'll keep the briefcase. He will cash in. And everybody is going to wet their pants, thinking, okay, he's going to take the title from Roman. We're going to get the happy ending finish. Only the Usos get involved with an assist from Paul Heyman. They all help Roman retain. Roman beats Braun Strowman. And what we end up with is something of a Samoan alliance with Roman Reigns as your heel champion, the Usos sort of as his backup in a way, and Paul Heyman as their advocate. Heyman brought up the Usos on Monday. I thought that was kind of odd that he did that, but he did. He's talked many times before, as I said, about the Samoans and the family and all of them. And it would also be a way, if they did this, to keep Heyman on television, maybe not even every single week, but to keep Heyman around even if Lesnar does not sign a new deal and just goes to the UFC. Now, I know the Usos are SmackDown guys, so you'd have to square that circle somehow. That's the one thing I haven't really figured out yet. But it just works. The Usos are not involved in any program right now. They're not even on the SummerSlam card. This entire pitch, by the way, is a takeoff of an idea that I already pitched on this podcast 2 years ago. Only this is with the addition of Heyman. But this is an idea that I've had before that I think you could easily implement tonight if they wanted to. I like the idea, and you're losing a babyface technically in Roman Reigns. I mean, I know not everybody cheers for the guy, but he's their biggest de facto babyface, I guess, next to Braun on this show. But you've got Braun. Braun is still over. I mean, despite the booking, and he hasn't really been doing much, he is still, over like Rover when he comes out and he gets these massive reactions. So you can sacrifice one because you have another, right? It's like WWE got really lucky in the late 90s that they had Austin and Rock at the same time. There is no Austin and Rock in this company now. Don't get me wrong. Roman Reigns is not Steve Austin or The Rock, and neither is Braun Strowman. But it's the closest thing I could think of because you've got these two guys. Now, Roman is booed mostly, but they see him as a big babyface. And then they have an actual huge babyface in Strowman. And I'd even throw Rollins in there too, although he's not really in the main event mix right now. But Rollins is also very popular. But they were fortunate enough back then where they could turn one because they had the other. You didn't need two huge babyfaces at the same time. I look at the top of the scene here on this Raw brand, and I'm just thinking to myself, Brock's not full-time. Who is the biggest heel right now on that roster? It's Roman Reigns, but he's not a heel. You know what I mean? Like, if you turn him, I guess there's always the risk that people will, start cheering him, but I don't think so. But I just think, the story is there, and you've got Braun is the guy who could chase. It's not like if you turn Roman, what do? Well, you got Braun. And eventually you'll have Rollins, if you want to go down that path and have Rollins, challenging Roman. So again, how likely is this to happen? Not very likely. But I'm going for broke here. That's my prediction. Either way, Roman wins. And so there you go. So that's your SummerSlam card. Long card. A lot of matches. I'll have a full review of the show up on the YouTube channel early tomorrow morning. So if you want to see the SummerSlam review video, it will be up then. You can get it there on the channel. And as always, you can find a link to download the MP3 if you want to stream. If you're, on your commute or whatever, you can't watch on YouTube, you have to go to the YouTube video. The link will be in the video description. Jim the Anvil Neidhart died earlier this week, 63 years old. This is on the heels of Bruno Sammartino passing away this year, Vader, Nikolai Volkoff, Brian Christopher, Matt Capitelli. That's not even all the names. So it's been one of those years, unfortunately, as far as wrestler deaths are concerned. And again, it's one thing if you have somebody who's in their 70s, 80s, 90s. Bruno was, I believe, in his 80s. Bruno lived a long, hell of a life that Bruno had. But guys like Vader and Anvil, and of course Brian Christopher, who wasn't even 50 years old, these are guys that should still be around. So just horrible, horrible news. Anvil had health issues, but this came as a shock to everybody. It wasn't a case where he was very, very sick on his deathbed. People were expecting this. He had a lot of issues. He's had issues in the past, but this was very unexpected. TMZ says he fell and hit his head very early in the morning. Actually, Ross Hart, who was his brother-in-law, he told the Associated Press that Neidhart suffered from Alzheimer's disease. And there was, a few months ago, Chris Nowinski, I think accidentally, let it leak. There was something he posted on Instagram, and he mentioned, he was talking about Natty and her bravery, in the face of her father suffering from Alzheimer's. And I think he took it down because he realized that that probably was not meant for public consumption. That's when the Alzheimer's story started to circulate about Neidhart. But now we hear from family members that pretty much say he had Alzheimer's. And it was believed that what happened is he suffered a seizure. He got up. He was very cold. He went to go change the thermostat in the middle of the night. And that's when they think he had a seizure. He fell, hit his head, and he started convulsing. And he passed away shortly thereafter. Bret Hart, was too broken up about it to even say anything. And Brett, usually, he puts out very nice blogs sometimes. He likes to write. Brett is a writer. I'm sure in due time he will have a lot to say about the Anvil. He was very close to him. He was family. They were tag team partners. They traveled the road for many years together. He was an instrumental part of his career. But he was too broken up to say anything about it. He posted on social media. He said, stunned and saddened. I just don't have the words right now. And I don't think anybody has heard from Brett since. So hopefully he's doing okay. But apparently Brett had been pushing very hard for a while now for WWE to induct the Hart Foundation. The tag team, I assume, not the faction, into the WWE Hall of Fame. Because he knew of Neidhart's Alzheimer's. And he knew that you know, there probably would not be too much time before it really started to impact him. And he wanted him to be able to be cognizant and aware and enjoy his induction into the Hall of Fame. I think, you know, Neidhart was kind of bitter about it too. I mean, he was at one of these WrestleCon type events and he was interviewed. I think it was an interview that was done on the Great North Wrestling Channel. That Devin Nicholson has. He's got some good content up there. And this is going back maybe a year or two. And you could tell in the interview, he was pretty bitter about the fact that he was not in the Hall of Fame. He may have accidentally referred to him as a Hall of Famer. Dave Penzer was interviewing him. And he's like, I'm not a Hall of Famer. And you could tell it really bothered him. So to hear that Brett knew of his struggles and was trying to lobby to get them to, you know, do something with the Hart Foundation before it was too late. And here we are. And you look at Vader. Vader passed away. Vader should be in the Hall of Fame. Vader will one day be in the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, like Macho Man and others, he will not be there to enjoy it. He will not be there to give his own induction speech. I think that sucks. I really do. And the Hart Foundation is a worthy, you know, it was a worthy team. You'll have the critics of Bret Hart saying, well, you know, of course he just wants to go into the Hall of Fame twice like Hulk Hogan did, or not Hogan, but Ric Flair. Hogan may well one day end up going in as part of the NWO or something, but it's just very sad. It's very sad that, you know, he won't have that opportunity. Just to give some background here, I didn't even know this, but in looking at some of the information on WWE.com, I was wondering, like, where did the nickname the Anvil come from? I've heard Brett talk about the Hitman nickname before, but not the Anvil. It comes from him winning an anvil throwing contest, or at least participating in an anvil throwing contest many, many years ago. An anvil throwing contest, by the way, sounds like an absolutely horrendous idea when you say that out loud. But that's where the name comes from. He did play for the Oakland Raiders and the Dallas Cowboys, although it was only, I think, in preseason games with the Raiders. And with the Cowboys, he attended their training camp, and he was cut after 3 weeks. And that was during the 1978 season where they went on to win the Super Bowl. He ended up getting trained by Stu Hart. He worked up in Stampede for a time before coming to WWE. He was paired off with Brett as the Hart Foundation. And Neidhart really was there, in large part, to help groom Brett, to get Brett ready for some bigger role down the road. Because if you watch the early days of the Hart Foundation, I mean, Anvil really was the soul of that team, man. I mean, the guy was charismatic. He could, you know, he could talk. Brett was just the shits back then. If you watch those early Hart Foundation promos, he got better over time. He got more comfortable. But I mean, you would watch and he was nervous. He just wasn't very good. The Anvil carried a lot of those interviews. But the goal and the idea was, you know, we have bigger ideas for Brett as a single one day, and so we'll pair him off with Neidhart, and, you know, he'll help him along. That was sort of the idea. The Hart Foundation, they were my second favorite tag team of all time, behind only Demolition. The Harts, the Bulldogs, Demolition, Strike Force, the Rougeaus, those were the teams that I grew up on, you know, in the Northeast watching WWE. After he got fired, Neidhart was out of the company for a while. He did come back. He came back in 1994. He turned heel. He aligned with Owen Hart. This after they had a brief stint in early 92 as the New Foundation. They were actually a tag team for a while. And it was funny, too, because the little period there of a few years after Neidhart got fired in 92, he actually worked for New Japan. He was part of the G1 Climax. We're just coming off the G1 Now imagine Jim the Anvil Neidhart in the G1. It's hard for me to sort of conceptualize this, but yeah, he was in the G1. He went to WCW. He was briefly in ECW before he finally came back to WWE in 94. He had a brief but memorable run for all of maybe a month or a couple of months as the masked man called Who on WWE television. That was in 1996. Which was so stupid. I mean, it was very obvious and clear to everybody who it was under the mask, but they put him under the mask anyway. In 97, he came back as himself, and he hooked up with Brett, Owen Bulldog, and Brian Pillman as the Hart Foundation faction. He was part of that legendary 10-man tag team match at the Calgary Saddle Dome, right? Canadian Stampede pay-per-view in July of 97. One of the greatest matches in company history. And really one of the best, I think two best Neidhart matches in his WWE run. The other being the 2 out of 3 falls match for the tag team titles at SummerSlam 1990 against Demolition. That actually Michael Cole mentioned that match on Monday night. Their SummerSlam 89 match against the Brainbusters is another favorite. That's a match, if you're looking for like a good SummerSlam, I guess SummerSlam is maybe over by the time you hear this, but if you're looking for a good SummerSlam match to go back and watch, that's, I think that opened the show at SummerSlam in 89, and that was a hell of a match. But yeah, I feel bad for Natty, obviously. She was very close to her father. She put a statement out and was saying, you know, she's overwhelmed by all the support and thanking everybody for all their kind words. I know that the Anvil made a lot of appearances on Total Divas. And so he was part of that reality show, and you know, she was very close to her father, and I know what it's like to lose a parent. It sucks. And one of the things, and I know people mean well when they say this, and I'm sure some of you can probably relate to this. Whenever something like that happens, you lose a parent, and somebody goes, oh, I know what you, I know how you feel. I know what you're going through. No, you don't. No, you don't. You think you do, but you don't. Even if you yourself have lost your mother, lost your father, no two experiences are the same. That's one of the worst things you could say to somebody. FYI, for future reference. There's certain things that you say to comfort people in times like that, and there are things that really should not be said. And not everybody may feel this way, but I do. That's one of those things that you really should avoid saying. Because you don't know how that might trigger somebody. Because, like I said, everybody goes through grief and experiences like that differently. No two experiences are the same. You don't know how I feel. And I hope that it's a long, long time before you ever have to know how I feel. So, it sucks. And you know, we also had another death this week, another wrestling death. I guess technically you can consider it a wrestling death. The Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, the legendary Aretha Franklin, passed away this week. I don't recall offhand what her age was, but I know she had a lot of health issues recently. But she performed at WrestleMania 3, right? It was America the Beautiful, I believe. WrestleMania 3, that legendary introduction by Vince McMahon, as only Vince could do it when he introduced her. And then 20 years later, they came back to Michigan. They came back to the Motor City, and WrestleMania 23, Aretha Franklin came back, and she sang again at the beginning of the show, which I thought was really cool. And depressingly, though, sadly, she was probably one of the few names that were still left alive from that WrestleMania 3 card. But yeah, so she has her place in wrestling history as well. And so that makes two wrestling deaths in the same week. I want to talk very briefly here about this Hulk Hogan story. Hulk Hogan was back in the news for all the wrong reasons this week, and I want to I first read the story. I'll give credit here to Fightful.com because I read this and I just thought to myself, I don't know what he's thinking. I think Hogan would be best suited to keep a low profile at this point when it comes to doing interviews like this. But this was the first interview, I believe, that he gave, first formal interview that he gave since the backstage meeting at the Extreme Rules pay-per-view when he met with the WWE roster. And Hogan was on the debut episode of the After Chat, which is a new podcast from Bill Apter, who I've had the pleasure of interviewing here on this show before. He's a wrestling royalty, is Bill Apter. And he's known Hogan for many, many, many years. And Hogan talked about being blackballed by the company after the tape leaked many years ago, and the racist comments came out. And so he was talking about that. And about the meeting at Extreme Rules, this is what Hogan said. He said, "A lot of people accepted my apology, and a lot of people heard what they wanted to hear. And a lot of the narrative that came out of the meeting was on point. A lot of the narrative was very different. I was surprised to hear some people interpreted what I said, that I was only sorry I got caught." One of the criticisms of the meeting was the fact that they took the approach of not only, apologizing, but you got to be careful, because in an age of social media and cell phone cameras and hidden cameras, you never know what or when you may be recorded. And I can understand why people would look at that and go, "This guy's full of shit. This guy's not sorry at all. He's sorry he got caught." He's more concerned about warning people, "Hey, I got caught on a secret recording. I got screwed here. I was done dirty, and you guys should make sure that the same thing doesn't happen to you." I'm not saying that any of that is wrong, and it's not right at all that Hogan was secretly recorded, but that's a completely separate issue. Your first time back in the locker room, this is your mea culpa. You're meeting with the entire locker room. You have the forum open to yourself to say whatever you want to say. All he had to do was apologize. That's it. All he had to do was say, I'm supremely embarrassed by this. It's not who I am. It's not in my heart. And all I can do is apologize and just hope that I conduct myself in a way where hopefully one day everybody can forgive me and give me a second chance. Something along those lines, boom, done. And that doesn't mean that everybody has to forgive him, but that's all he had to do. But when I heard about the account of that meeting and how, there was a whole other component to it, and he's talking about social media and privacy, that was not the time or place for that. That was not a locker room, I don't think, that was there to hear about Hulk Hogan bitch about how he got caught and didn't know he was being recorded. So that was his big mistake coming out of that meeting. But if you remember, when the meeting was over, New Day put out a joint statement, Titus O'Neil put out a statement, and they didn't seem like they were so willing and so quick to forgive Hogan. It's not that they're closed off to the idea, but Titus O'Neil in particular, I think, said that there was absolutely nothing in that meeting that Hogan said that convinced him that he was really, truly sorry for what he had done. So clearly there were some people who came out of that meeting not with a very favorable impression of Hogan. But where he put his foot in his mouth here is this next comment that he made. And this is where I just kind of shook my head. He said, "I just hope the brotherhood can get back to the way it was. Outside the ring, you're supposed to protect your brother. In this case..." And I did laugh a little bit, him using the word brother, because he just uses that word all the time. So I'm reading this, and literally I'm like, I hear his voice in my head saying this. So it's like, outside the ring, you're supposed to protect your brother. But he says, "In this case, it's a situation where 75, 80, 90% of the wrestlers are protecting me, and they're giving me another chance to move forward. There are just a few wrestlers that don't understand the bond and the brotherhood of wrestling." So we all know who he's calling out with those comments. He says, "If somebody makes a mistake, you need to forgive them. You need to forgive them," he says, "and move on and try to let them prove themselves." Now, I will give Hogan, I will say this much about one thing that he said in this interview. He said that at the meeting in, was it Pittsburgh, I guess, he asked if anybody had any questions for him. He said the only person who stood up to ask a question was Mark Henry. Okay, and then he had this quote. He said, "I just wanted to be able to, if anybody had any questions or anybody had anything at all to say at the time, I really wanted them to say it to my face so I could address it. Hopefully, understand the issue and have a chance to get them to understand me." And I do think that's a fair point that Hogan makes, if what he's saying is true. Okay, it's Hogan here, so we have to take, his account of things, we have to take with a grain of salt here. But I will say that I agree with him on that point. If there were people who still had serious concerns and serious reservations about him or how genuine he was being, and I don't care if it was just a case of they didn't, people there were afraid to say anything, maybe they didn't want to get in the bad graces of Triple H or Vince McMahon and cause a scene in front of their employer, whatever the excuse is. If you have an issue with Hogan, you should raise your hand and confront the guy, even if you just go off to the side so nobody hears you and nobody sees you, and say, "Hey, Hulk, I'd like to talk to you for a second." I mean, Titus has some pretty strong words for him. Why didn't Titus pull him aside and have a conversation with him? And even if Titus just said, look, I'm not asking you a question. I have a statement, a comment I'd like to make. I just want you to listen. I just want you to hear what I have to say. Apparently, they didn't do that. And I think that they should have. If Hogan put the forum out, you know, put the forum out there for anybody to speak up and, hey, if you got something to say to me, please come say it to my face. Then you know what? They should have said it to his face. Or they should have pulled him aside and said it. And they could still put their public statement out. I thought that the statements New Day and Titus put out were very classy and well-worded, and it was fine. But I'll give Hogan points for that. He's got a point there. But this thing about how wrestling is a brotherhood and how you've got to forgive and just move on, I'm sure Hogan would love it if everybody forgave him and just moved on and acted like it never happened. I am sure that that's what Hogan wants. What is this brotherhood bullshit when it comes to, you know, you were caught on tape saying racist shit. You were saying some pretty horrible racist shit on tape. I don't, you know, however many years ago it was, and your privacy was violated, that's horrible, but it happened. You can't put the genie in the bottle. These people obviously were offended by this, and I'm sure in some cases these are people that respected Hogan. Maybe they grew up on Hogan, they liked Hogan, and then they hear something like that, and of course they're going to be hurt. Of course it's going to bother them, and it's going to be tough for them to just turn around and be like, ah, all right, I forgive you. It's all is forgiven. It's all water under the bridge. Right? I don't blame any of them for feeling the way they feel, but this bullshit about a brotherhood, I just wish the brotherhood could go back to the way it was. This isn't you being in a match, giving your body to somebody and saying, hey, brother, you know, we're all on the same page here. You protect me, I'll protect you. This is not a fucking match. You said a bunch of racist bullshit. And surprise, surprise, some of the black wrestlers on the roster aren't so quick to say you're forgiven. Which is certainly an opinion that they are entitled to have. They don't ever have to forgive Hogan if they don't want to. And Titus, you know, I know his kids and his family is very important to him. And, you know, I'm sure that bothers him as well. You know, he's being very careful about how he conducts himself. He's trying to set a good example for his kids. And, you know, I get that. But when I read that one quote from Hogan about, you know, the brotherhood isn't what it used to be. And I wish it could go back to the way it was. And, you know, if you make a mistake, you got to forgive them. That's a pretty big fucking mistake to make, though. Right? I mean, come on. If you go back and listen to the comments, it's not hard to understand why these people would be so upset. So I think the brotherhood comment was just complete bullshit. He did himself no favors by making that comment. It was a stupid thing for him to say. But I will say that, yeah, if he open the forum for people to ask questions and confront him and talk to him at the meeting, then if people had real issues with him, they should have, you know, gone to him face to face to at least let him know face to face how they really feel. But I think it would be safer for Hogan to not give interviews like this anymore. If this is his idea of damage control, he's not going to do himself any favors by doing more interviews like this. Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer found himself in some hot water this week, a lot of hot water, scalding hot water, for some comments that he made on one of his radio shows about Peyton Royce. I think it was Wrestling Observer Radio on his website. It was him and Brian Alvarez. They were having a conversation about the Iconics, and this was the exchange that was isolated. Somebody isolated this clip and actually posted it on Twitter and tagged Peyton in it. And that's how she became aware of it. But this was the clip that was posted from the show. Meltzer said, I thought the Iconics had a cool act in NXT and on the main roster. I just don't get a thing out of them. I don't think their promos are particularly good. Their wrestling isn't good. I think Peyton's transformation to look more attractive, I don't know, I don't want to say, but I don't think that. And then Alvarez butts in and says that they were more attractive in NXT, and Meltzer says, I thought so, yes. To me, I would say so, but that's neither here nor there. And, you know, Alvarez says, well, nobody's saying that anyone's unattractive or that Peyton is unattractive, and Meltzer says, no, of course. But he says, she doesn't stand out to me. When she was in NXT, she did. She was a lot lighter. Now, to hear me say it is you really should just listen to the clip yourself. And really, you should listen to the full segment or full show. Because me saying it sounds horrible. Dave saying it, it sounded horrible. There's just no other way around it. And Peyton Royce reacted to this by saying, "So what would you have me do, Dave? Starve myself? This is how nightmares for young women start. The females in your life must be proud." Meltzer has since apologized profusely for what he said. He said he takes full responsibility for it, hopes that others can learn from his stupid mistake. My thought on it is this. I read The Observer every week. And I have heard the, podcast that he has done before. I know how he speaks. I know the kind of things he talks about. So I go into this knowing how he writes and how he speaks when he is on his shows. And I knew what he was talking about when he said it. He was not saying that Peyton Royce is fat. He was not insulting Peyton Royce's looks. He was not trying to be offensive to her in any way, in a malicious way. But what he said came off absolutely horribly. There's no real way around it. What he said and the way he said it was terrible. Because Peyton Royce is not sitting on the tour bus going from city to city listening to fucking Dave Meltzer podcasts. So she has no idea. Someone sends her a clip. And it's of Dave talking about how I used to like her more in NXT. And now she used to be lighter. And so what is she going to think? I can't even really blame her because she doesn't know. She has no context to any of this. And frankly, even if she did have context, she still has a right to be offended and be hurt by what he said. So he apologized, as he should have, because he sounded like a complete idiot the way that it came out. But it was worded very badly. I think the reaction has been way, way over the top on this. To the point where I kind of feel sorry for Dave. I really do. It's one of those situations where you pile on somebody so much for something. And you make it out to be something that it really wasn't. That you actually start to have some sympathy for that person. And that's kind of where I find myself with this whole situation. I think he said a stupid thing. He should have apologized for it, and he did. And I think he's sincere in his apology. There are some people who will apologize for things, and it's pretty fucking obvious that they're just saying it to save their skin. They're not being genuine. They have a history of doing these things, and then they go right back to doing it. I really don't think that's the case here. Just, based on, this is my personal opinion, having, read the guy's work and listened to him before, I understand what he was saying. What he was referring to was the fact that, and I don't even know if this is confirmed or not. I don't know if Peyton's ever publicly talked about this, but he's inferring that she had work on her breasts, that she had breast augmentation to make her breasts larger. And there was a period of time, I think, actually, where both Iconics were out for a while. I don't think they were hurt. And that was the rumor or the belief was that they were taking time off to have cosmetic surgery, and then eventually they came back. And so that's what he was referring to. And he has talked about this before. It's been even in the newsletter and stuff, when certain people disappear for a while, right? And then eventually they return. Why they were away, they kind of took a little vacation. And it's inferred that a lot of the women, not all of them, but a lot of the women have had work done on their chest. Now, that could be, it could be because they wanted to and it was their own choice. They did so of their own volition. Or it could be that they did it because they just felt that, or maybe it was even inferred to them, if not directly told to them, that, hey, you might want to do this. Or they feel like, well, I'm looking at these other women and I feel like it'll help my career if I have this done. So for the sake of my job, I'm going to do this, or I feel I have to do that. Whatever their rationale is behind it, right? There's different reasons why the women may decide to do it. But, whatever it is. Me personally, when it comes to this kind of stuff, I don't give a shit. I really don't. If it's their own choice, go for it. If they're doing it only because they feel it's what the company wants or because they're not going to get a push unless they get bigger boobs, go for it. I don't care. I don't watch wrestling to see women, you know, I only watch wrestling because I'm watching their tits and ass. That's not why I watch wrestling. Maybe some people do. To me, if I need that sort of gratification, believe me, there's this thing called the internet. There's plenty of other places where you can go and get that. That's not why I watch WWE. So I honestly, for me personally, I don't care. I don't care if they've had their boobs done or not. It doesn't faze me. It doesn't bother me. And even the times when I would hear or read Meltzer talking about it, you know, it's like, okay, who cares? You know, I may crack a joke every now and then when somebody comes back and looks different than they did the last time, you know, because it's funny. But I don't really spend too much time thinking about it myself. And look, if they do it, if they feel like it's going to help advance their career, guess what? Welcome to the world of entertainment. Remember, Vince McMahon once upon a time had Roman Reigns wearing blue contact lenses to make him more marketable. Yeah, good times. That only lasted for a few months. But shit like this happens all the time. Men, women, wrestling, television, movies, whatever it may be. This shit goes on all the time. I'm not even sure why it's a big story or why it's a big deal. I mention all of this, though, because that was what Dave was referring to. He was not calling her fat. He was not saying she's fat, she's thin, she's this, she's that. Like, I understood the context of what he was saying. I'm not saying that it should have been said or that it didn't come out the wrong way, because it absolutely did, and it was pretty embarrassing. But this reaction, this overreaction to this, every wrestler jumped on top of Meltzer. You had Seth Rollins, minus 6 stars, and you had all the MVP, and just all of these different people who felt the need to chime in on this. And it's this mob mentality that sort of takes over, you know? Everybody just gangs up. Bischoff, I mean, Bischoff is somebody who just hates Meltzer anyway, but I mean, he never misses a chance to crap all over him. We know that. And the thing about it is that I get that they're all friends, and I get that they feel like they're a family. And when someone attacks a member of your family, what's your first instinct? You feel compelled to respond. You feel compelled to come to their defense and to do something about it. And I think that's what we're seeing here with the WWE roster. I think they also probably didn't quite understand the context of what was being said. They heard the clip and they heard about what happened, and they heard that, you know, somebody went after Peyton Royce. How could you possibly do this? Peyton Royce, she's an angel. She's this very nice person, this beautiful young lady. How dare you say something so horrible about her? And so they all jumped on Meltzer, and they all had to chime in on this. Renee Young, to me, was the most offensive of all the people who did. And that was really disappointing, actually, because I like Renee. I think she's, very down to earth in the way she comes across on TV, which is rare because there's a lot of people on that show who come across as just a robot and no personality. And Renee actually looks, sounds, and feels like a real person. But she chimed in and she called Meltzer a true piece of sweltering hot garbage. That was her reaction to that clip. What a true piece of sweltering hot garbage is what she said. Now, I can tell you that when I call somebody a piece of garbage, which isn't very often, but it happens, if I'm going to call somebody a piece of garbage, then you can bet your ass that they deserve to be called a piece of garbage. And there are a lot of people who probably deserve to be called a piece of garbage. I don't believe Dave Meltzer is one of them. I think that to call him a piece of hot garbage for, you know, talking about how, you know, Peyton Royce used to be lighter when she, you know, didn't have cosmetic surgery or, you know, however it was that, again, he phrased it. I mean, he was playing verbal gymnastics, he was. And that, I think he did it to himself, frankly, because instead of just coming out and saying that, he was sort of dancing around it. And that didn't do himself any favors. So, of course, people are going to hear that and they're going to think, well, he's talking about something else. Because these people don't listen to him. They're not in that little bubble. They have no idea what he's really referring to here. Fucking Jalen Rose on ESPN. They had Jalen Rose asking Charlotte about. Do you think fucking Jalen Rose is sitting at home listening to Dave Meltzer on his fucking iPod? I mean, come on. But everybody chimes in, and the whole gang gets together, and this is the end result here. It became a huge, huge story. It became a far bigger story than it should have. Now, maybe something good comes out of it, and that it starts some kind of discussion about women and their looks and how you've got to be respectful and there are certain things not to say. Hey, I'm on board with that, 100%. But I think all of the hate and everything that was directed towards this one individual was completely ridiculous. He apologized for it. He didn't even waste any time in apologizing for it either. I mean, I think he realized pretty quickly that he'd done fucked up. So he took responsibility for it. I mean, I just got done talking about Hulk Hogan. Hogan apologized for what he did. I would not compare the comments that Hogan made, though, to what Dave Meltzer said, which is why Hogan's sort of in the rut that he's in, where there are some people who just can't forgive him for what he said. The two situations are not exactly the same. It kind of comes down, I think, to the actual words and what was said. But to sum this whole thing up here, he said a stupid thing. He apologized for it. The context was twisted because what he was referring to, he did a very poor job of articulating it. And I think there's a lesson learned for him and everybody else here. And the lesson is this. The lesson is that if you've got something to say, just come out and say it. Don't play games with words. Words matter. Language is very important. I've said that on the show before. Be clear in what you are trying to say, because there are people who will misinterpret you, who will misunderstand you, and will take it the wrong way. And there could also be people who frankly have it out for you, who probably were just, you know, creaming their pants over being able to jump all over this guy. I'm sure that was there were some people who did that too. But whether you like the guy or not shouldn't have anything to do with this. Whether you're a Meltzer fan or a Meltzer hater, you can't stand the guy's guts, and it doesn't matter. Just look at the situation for what it was and what he was trying to say. He did an awful job of articulating it. I honestly, in my heart, don't believe that this is an evil person who is, you know, being evil and malicious in what he was trying to say. But he still said it. He fucked up. He paid the price for it. But I think the reaction from all of the wrestlers in particular jumping on top of him, it's the family thing. I get that. But it was way overblown. And Renee Young, as an example, just using her as an example, her jumping on social media to call this guy a piece of human garbage or whatever it was, that's just one example of the overreaction, I think, to this story. NXT TakeOver Brooklyn 4 was from the Barclays Center just last night. And unfortunately, not only is all those superstars on Raw and SmackDown not immune to dumb babyface syndrome, but neither is Johnny Wrestling. He let his emotions get the better of him at the end of the main event, and he paid the price for it. Tommaso Ciampa, still NXT champion, after another excellent takeover show. I think it would be news if one of these takeover shows was not an excellent show. That would be the big story. All of these Brooklyn takeovers have been outstanding. It's just too bad they will not be doing another one next summer, since they're already going to be doing one in April, and now I hear rumors, nothing confirmed, but rumors that Toronto may be the favorite for SummerSlam, and I guess if they get SummerSlam, they would probably get NXT TakeOver next August. So I suspect that they'll be making an announcement one way or the other very soon, but Toronto is the latest rumor I'm hearing. I did go to the show. For those of you wondering if I made it or not, I did go. Fourth row ringside, not a bad view. We had Stephanie McMahon with her kids. I think they were sitting a couple of rows in front of us. She was there the entire show. And 2 hour left was former WCW World Heavyweight Champion himself, David Arquette, taking in the action. Ronda Rousey and her husband, UFC fighter Travis Brown, were brought out after the very first match. They sat in the same row with Arquette. And she was marking out the entire time. Every time I looked over and I saw Ronda, she was just cheering and chanting or booing. If it was the Kairi Sane match, she was booing Kairi. Just having so much fun out there. It was actually nice to see. There were two matches that were taped for NXT television this week. I missed the Bianca Belair-Deonna Purrazzo match. And I got there in time to see the last half of the United Kingdom Championship match with Pete Dunne defending against Zach Gibson. I'm not going to give away any spoilers, other than to say that what I saw of the Dunn-Gibson match was very good. The show itself opened with Mustache Mountain, Tyler Bate, and Trent Seven challenging the Undisputed Era for the NXT Tag Team titles. No surprise here. Strong and O'Reilly retain. They just won the belts back. No real need to switch them again. This time it was Tyler Bate's knee that got worked over for a dramatic effect, not Trent Seven's, which we saw a few weeks ago on NXT television. Although Trent Seven did grab a white towel, he teased doing for him what Bate did for Seven a few weeks ago by throwing the towel in. Everyone's chanting, no, 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 don't do it. And he tossed the towel into the stands instead. He got a hot tag. They hit their finish on Kyle O'Reilly, but he kicked out. Bate was taken out by Strong, which left Seven all by his lonesome. He fell victim to total elimination and was pinned. Undisputed Era retains. These two teams can just do no wrong together. I mean, there was a period of time on the main roster where I felt the same way about New Day and Usos. They had tons and tons of matches, and one was better than the next until they built to that great Hell in a Cell match that they had. And these two teams, look, I mean, some teams just have great chemistry. These two teams have it. And I could watch these guys all day long. One of the best series of matches of any kind, I think, all year. And the War Raiders came out through the crowd at the end. They left Strong and O'Reilly laying to set up their next program. EC3 and the Velveteen Dream. Dream came out with the words, "Call me up, Vince," on the back of his ass. You shut your damn mouth with that nonsense, you hear me? I don't want to be hearing none of that. On the post-show conference call, Triple H said the first time he saw Dream's tights was when he showed it to the hard camera. So he didn't see it backstage. When he flashed it on TV is when he saw it. And on the call, he said, maybe I should see stuff like that ahead of time. He goes, there are calls from Vince that you want to get, and there are calls from Vince that you don't want to get. And that is why we cannot have nice things. I thought it was great. So, first half of the match really wasn't anything special, to be honest. Dream, he gave EC3 a DDT on the ramp. Things started to really pick up after that point. He was working over the neck of EC3. EC3 hit a superplex on Dream later on and sold his neck. Somewhere in here, I'm not sure where, EC3 got a cut over his eye. Because after the match, the eye was very badly swollen. Dream gave him a Death Valley driver on the apron, which, of course, say it with me, is the hardest part of the ring. You know, I was thinking about this. Wouldn't the hardest part of the ring technically be the ring post? Right? Would seem logical to me if we're going to be real technical about it. But this is the second hardest part of the ring. After that, Dream went up top. EC3 is still laying on the apron, mind you. He goes up to the top rope and delivers the purple Rainmaker elbow drop to EC3 on the apron. Rolls him back inside and gets the pin. This was the weakest match on the show, but it was still good. It was still good. But of the five, I would put this one at the bottom of the pile. The most important thing about this is that the right man won. Dream was super over in Brooklyn. I mean, the guy's a superstar. He comes out, he gets superstar reaction. He's still very young. He'll get better, but he is, he's a star in the making. I mean, he's already a star to these people, but he's going to do big things. He is well on his way, and he needed this win. He really did. Of the two, he needed this more than EC3 did, so the right man won. They showed their newest signee. They did make it official on WWE.com. Matt Riddle has officially signed with the NXT brand. They showed him on camera sitting in the crowd. He tried to get a bro chant going, and it worked. There was a loud bro chant in the building. They've got a license to print money. I mean, you talk about a star in the making with somebody like Velveteen Dream. They've got a license to print money with this guy if they play their cards right. Will they? I trust in NXT he'll do very well. I think he will on the main roster too. I just feel like he's too charismatic from what I've seen of him. He's too charismatic and too good not to be a big star. I guess, you got to worry about the company, but you got to worry about the individual as well. As long as he stays on the straight and narrow and does what he's supposed to do, I think he'll do very well for himself. Adam Cole and Ricochet for the NXT North American Championship. I am sure many of you noticed the little nod to Ricochet on Lucha Underground this past week. They had a priest named Father Rick O'Shea in the audience. They had him get his arm snapped. Pentagon actually snapped the arm of a priest. Neck collar and all. And people cheered. These people are sick. But I liked it. This was the match of the night right here. This stole the show. This is my favorite match of the entire show. Just an outstanding battle. Especially those last 7 or 8 minutes or so. I mean, and I could tell you, in the building, people were losing their shit for this match. One of the all-time great spots, right? People talk about that time Shelton Benjamin springboarded off the ropes and Shawn Michaels caught him flush, boom, right in the face with Sweet Chin Music. I don't know that this was better than that. I mean, I don't think Shawn could have nailed that kick any more perfectly than he did, but this was up there with a spot like that. And if this thing doesn't make the highlight reel, then they're doing something wrong. Ricochet, I thought he was setting up for a lethal injection, but instead he hits the ropes. He goes for a moonsault off the second rope. Okay, it's like he got some height on this. It's like a lion salt on steroids here. He gets way up into the air, and on his way down, Adam Cole hit a perfectly timed super kick right to Ricochet's neck on the way down. It looked like the face, but then they showed the replay, and he landed the foot right in the neck. He looked like he murdered this poor bastard. And afterward, you could see the giant red welt that it left on Ricochet's neck. They replayed this thing 3 or 4 times. It looked even better in slow-mo. Everybody lost their minds. Michael Cole immediately transitioned into a brainbuster. Michael Cole. Oh, my God. Adam Cole. This was definitely not a move that Michael Cole, I think, could hit. Adam Cole, God, you know, I'm worried about that too, because we kind of joked about that when Adam Cole eventually hits the main roster, we hope that they don't make him the long-lost son of Michael Cole or something, and here I am, I'm calling him Michael Cole. What do you think Vince is going to do? But no, Adam Cole then immediately followed up with a brainbuster onto the knee, got a close near fall. Everybody thought that was the finish. They had me fooled, and I mean, I had picked Ricochet to win. So even still, they had me fooled on that near fall. After that, they traded some stiff kicks and chops back and forth until both guys fell down. The crowd gave them a standing ovation. Ricochet hit a reverse Rana, spiked Cole head first into the mat. He climbed up top for the 630. Cole wisely rolls out to the apron. But that doesn't stop Ricochet. I think he could have rolled out to the middle of the aisleway, and Ricochet would have found his way over in one giant leap. So Ricochet, he sort of surveys the situation here, and he proceeds to leap over the ropes, and in one motion, he hits a Rana on Cole, off the apron, and onto the floor. And he immediately rolls him back inside. He hits a picture-perfect 630 for the win, and with that, we have a new North American champion. Ricochet gets his first taste of gold in WWE. I cannot say enough good things about this match. These guys are two of the very best in this entire promotion. I saw something in the Facebook group. I guess somebody wasn't impressed by Adam Cole. They said, I don't see what's so impressive about this guy. He's very bland. He's very basic. Well, watch this match. Okay, Ricochet is obviously, I mean, he could do things that nobody else can. You don't have a match like this just because one of the two parties is good at what they do. So I don't want to hear this nonsense about how Adam Cole is overrated or is... his talent isn't what people make it out to be. You're full of shit. And this match is a great example of that. Kairi Sane and Shayna Baszler for the NXT Women's Championship. They brought out the remaining MMA horsewomen to join Ronda at ringside for this match. Marina Shafir and Jessamyn Duke, who have been training for months, and apparently they're picking this wrestling thing up pretty quick. This was an excellent match. This was the best women's match in NXT in a very long time. I'd have to go back and see when the last truly great women's match was. But it's been a while. There have been some good matches on TV. There was one actually recently, I think, with Candice LeRae and Shayna. But the last, like, really excellent, really great one was a while ago. And this was the latest one here. These two came into this match tied at one win apiece. Kairi beat Baszler in the finals last year, the very first Mae Young Classic. Baszler beat Sane with a choke on NXT television back in February. And the story here was simple. Kairi came in as the underdog. Baszler has been the dominant bully champion. She tortured Kairi during this match. She was twisting and contorting her leg and her ankle in ways that it should never be twisted. I did love the way that Baszler mocked Kairi at one point. She did the little pirate march out of the corner. I laughed. I thought that was funny. Kairi started firing up with each shot. Like she was hulking up, And she fought back. She showed off, I guess, her fighting spirit, you might say. She gave Shayna a spinning back fist that knocked her into the middle of next week. That reminded me of one of those old Aja Kong spinning back fists, although Aja had more on it than Kairi did. Kairi's a lot smaller than Aja Kong was. But she gave her an insane elbow drop from the top to Baszler's back. I think it was the top of the middle rope, but she hit the elbow on Shayna's back. And then she delivered a second insane elbow drop, but Shayna kicked out. I believe that makes her the first person ever to do so. I could be wrong, but she's the first one I can remember to kick out of that move. Kairi went to put the anchor submission on her, but Baszler countered that into a rear naked choke. You figured at this point, I figured it was academic at this point, but Kairi made it to the ropes. She ended up going up for a third insane elbow, but when she came off, and by the way, I'm watching her going up like, for the third time for this elbow, and I'm just thinking, boy, she's doing an awfully good job of speeding up that hip replacement. But on her way down, Baszler got her feet up. She kicked Kairi's arm on the way down. She grabbed her from behind to take her down for the choke. Kairi rolled through when she got pulled backwards, though. So this was right out of the Bret Hart-Roddy Piper playbook from WrestleMania 8 or the Bret Hart-Steve Austin match from Survivor Series in 1996. Baszler's shoulders were down, and Kairi wins the championship. And as Shayna said when the match was over, she was backstage with the other horsewomen being interviewed by Kathy Kelly, and she said, look, Kairi Sane didn't beat me. I lost. But she didn't beat me. So I guess that'll be the story coming out of this match. This was the one outcome I got wrong when I did the predictions. I thought Baszler would retain. I thought she should retain. I like the job they've done with her as champion, but my guess is they did it this way because she's going to get called up to the Raw roster soon, and possibly even as early as tomorrow. If she's going to get called up, it has to be the Raw roster, obviously, because that's where Ronda Rousey is. So whether they're going to wrestle or partner, it would have to be the Raw roster if she's going to get called up. And look, you know, maybe they're setting it up for horsewomen against horsewomen at the Evolution pay-per-view. Maybe that's why they went with Trish against Alexa instead of Trish against Sasha Banks. Either way, I think Baszler's probably the next one getting called up. I would have expected Aleister Black. I mean, I said that about a month and a half ago, that I figured he was going to get called up the night after SummerSlam. You know, he would not win the championship back, and then he would get called up. But then he got hurt. Main event was Tommaso Ciampa defending his NXT championship against Johnny Gargano in a last man standing match for the title. Both these guys, much like Baszler and Kairi Sane, came into this match tied at one win apiece. Gargano won their first encounter. That was after Ciampa came back from knee surgery. And Ciampa won the rematch. That was at the Chicago show. This was supposed to be a triple threat match with Aleister Black, but Rikishi ran him over. And so we were left with another singles match here between these two guys. In my opinion, you know, Johnny Gargano has been the MVP of NXT in 2018. He has now headlined every TakeOver show this year. And has had, in my opinion, the best match in NXT history with Andrade Cien Almas. And that was to start the year. Then came those two great matches with Ciampa, and you can add a third now to the list. This was also an excellent match, although probably my least favorite of the three that they've had so far. And I think that's largely because this was the third straight match with virtually the same rules. The match is really, stipulation-wise, have not been that different. This time they added in the little wrinkle, obviously, of the last man standing stip. But all three matches have basically been no DQ, anything goes weapons matches. You can only do that so often before you start to run out of ideas. Now, they did have some, a couple of innovative things here that I hadn't seen them do before. But, you know, pulling up the mats, we've seen them do that before, going through tables and using this and that. I mean, we've seen a lot of this already. But that didn't make the match any less good than it was. They had Ciampa come out. You know, he has the best entrance music in all of wrestling. The sounds of hatred and contempt, which any great heel would die for. He basically stole Roman Reigns' entrance music from him. And Johnny Gargano comes out. He comes out to a largely positive reaction, although more mixed than he's had before. You know, through this whole story with Ciampa, It's changed Gargano, right? That's the story here. He has not been the same since that loss to Ciampa in Chicago. And then he gave Ciampa the accidental assist in winning the NXT title. And that threw him off the deep end even more and did not ingratiate him very well with many of the fans. They chanted, "You deserve it," at him after Aleister Black kicked him in the face a few weeks ago. So Johnny is a flawed character on this show. He's like Rick on The Walking Dead if NXT was a drama and went about three seasons too long. Johnny pulled up some of the mats on the outside. Fans chanted, "EC-dub, EC-dub," more like EC-dumb to me. Of all the things to associate with ECW, really? Pulling up mats on the floor? Come on. They brawled over to one of the announce desks. Ciampa hit a running air raid crash on Gargano through the Spanish announce table. It's always the Spanish announce tables. Always, right? How long before people get offended by that? And the company is forced to apologize to all of their Spanish-speaking fans and make the promise that they will never again damage the table because it's very unfair that it's always their desk and hardly ever the other ones that get broken. I'm sure people will find something to be upset about. Gargano lawn darted Ciampa into a chair that was wedged in between two turnbuckles, the top and the middle turnbuckles. And I looked over at Stephanie. She did not seem to like that very much. And she liked it even less when Ciampa hit the devil's wings on the steps. That came a little bit later. But Gargano set up two tables outside the ring, one face up, the other face down. On top of that one, with the table legs sticking up, Ciampa was punishing him with chair shots, and then he opens the chair and he takes a seat as the referee starts to count. Johnny beats the count just in time and then super kicks Ciampa out of his seat, so that was cool. I mentioned the Devil's Wings. He hit the Devil's Wings, which is his finish. That's the move he used to win the NXT title. He hit that on Gargano on the steel ring steps. Somehow, Gargano beat the count at the very last second. And so Ciampa starts removing some of the padding from inside the ring. It's a kind of a callback to their street fight in Chicago. They're exposing the wooden boards underneath. And Gargano blasts Ciampa in the face with a fire extinguisher, blinding him. He grabbed a crutch. He broke it over his back, draping DDT by Gargano onto the wood boards. The same move Ciampa used to beat him once before. Ciampa rolled out of the ring, and when he landed on his feet, that constituted a break in the count, which was smart, and remember that because that's going to play into things a little bit later here. Gargano hit not one but two separate suicide dives. Two suicide dives to Ciampa on the opposite sides of the ring. Accidentally, Johnny Gargano then accidentally super kicks a member of the production crew. And that reminded me of the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12. Was it Chimmel? I think it was Chimmel that Sean superkicked by accident. Pretty sure it was Tony Chimmel. But anyway, Ciampa hit a running knee strike that collapsed the boards by the timekeeper's area. And in a funny spot, Ciampa grabs the dead body of the production guy. He places him on top of Gargano and proceeds to bury Johnny in a mountain of debris. He's throwing chairs over, just whatever he could get his hands on, anything to keep this guy down for the 10 count. But still, he made it to his feet. Ciampa grabbed a pair of handcuffs. Gargano wrestled them away from him and put the cuffs on one of Ciampa's wrists. He super kicked him off the apron. Remember those two stacked tables I mentioned? Well, he went right through them and made it back to his feet, though, in time. They took the fight up the ramp and onto the stage. And Johnny handcuffs him to a part of the stage, and he delivers a series of super kicks. And you know, each time Ciampa is begging off, and he's apologizing, and Johnny is just kicking him each time for it. And Johnny is wasting so much time here. Each time he would kick him, he would stand there, he would stare at him, he would talk to him. And he was just wasting so much time, and everybody in my section is like, "Come on, do something, end this, come on, finish him off." And he just was not in his right frame of mind. Johnny Gargano was not in his right frame of mind. He is obsessed with hurting Tommaso Ciampa more than he is winning the match. He pulls down his knee pad. He delivers a running knee strike and hits Ciampa. But in doing so, not only does he hit Ciampa, but Johnny himself goes flying off the stage. He couldn't stop his momentum. And he goes flying off the stage and over a bunch of production boxes, and he lands on the floor. Both guys are down. The referee starts counting. Both men are being counted out here. Johnny tries to get to his feet, but he can't. He hurt his knee. He falls to the ground. Ciampa, who is still cuffed to the stage, but he was kind of on the edge, he rolls off the stage and lands on his feet. Because remember now, the stage is only raised, like, compared to the way it used to be back in the day, like on Raw, they had the tall stage. It's 2-3 feet now, maybe. Ciampa rolls off at the count of nine and lands on his feet. The floor broke his fall. But because he landed on his feet, that meant that he made it to his feet in time and Johnny Gargano did not. And therefore, Tommaso Ciampa retains his NXT championship. The virus has spread to NXT. Dumb babyface syndrome strikes again. Of all the things this man could have done, he had his opponent handcuffed. And he had to deliver a running knee and send himself flying to his doom. Johnny Wrestling becomes Johnny Dumbass here at NXT TakeOver. And he paid the price for it. I could tell you that the crowd absolutely hated this finish. I was underwhelmed by it, but I get that it advances the story. And sometimes you got, you know, you have to do that to have this kind of a finish. I know it's frustrating, but, you know, so I get it. But it was, it definitely took the air out of our sails in the building. But I'll say this, I would rather they do what they did here and have a winner, as opposed to what I was fearing they might do, which is a last man standing match where both guys knock each other out and neither guy can make it to their feet and it ends in a draw with no winner. I think that would have been a far worse finish. Mauro Ranallo on commentary, apparently, I haven't had the chance to go watch all this back on the TV version. But from what I understand on commentary, he was making reference to the fact that Johnny may have dislocated his knee or his kneecap. Triple H talked about that after the show. He did a post-show conference call, and he talked about it as though it was a legitimate injury. He said there were only two injuries coming out of the show. EC3 got dinged up, which is his eye, and he mentioned Johnny might have hurt his knee, and he said that it actually changed some of their technical plans for the finish of the show. So his injury sounds like it may be legit, and it may have actually impacted how the finish went down. Maybe that was why it felt like he was almost stalling a little bit. I don't know, but it sounds like he may be hurt. Hopefully it's nothing too serious that keeps him out for a long time. But here's what I would do with these two guys, because you say to yourself, okay, now what, right? Ciampa won. So where does Gargano go from here? I would keep these two apart for the next 6 months, if we assume that neither guy is being called up anytime soon. I would keep them apart for 6 months. And if Johnny is legitimately injured, he may be out for a while anyway, which makes it easier. Ciampa can defend in the meantime against Aleister Black. It doesn't sound like Aleister is going to be gone very long. Triple H on the call said that it's the doctor's call. Whenever he thinks Black is ready, he'll be back. So it doesn't sound like he's going to be gone for very long. They can build to Gargano finally winning the NXT Championship from Tommaso Ciampa in Brooklyn next year, WrestleMania weekend. They come back to this feud. They have that one final blow-off match in Brooklyn, and it can be the first ever NXT Hell in a Cell match. But you think about all the matches these guys have had so far. It always spills out of the ring. They brawl all over the ringside area. They go into the crowd. They go up the aisle. They're on the stage. Hell in a Cell, right? It's a brutal match concept, but in the context of their own feud, because they're always, you know, brawling everywhere all over the building, this keeps them contained inside. Although, you know, I mean, Hell in a Cell, rarely does Hell in a Cell actually keep people inside, but that would be the idea. Instead of just doing a cage match, you do a Hell in a Cell, which they've never done before. And that was the idea I pitched for them in the Chicago show. I mean, that was the idea that I had for their Chicago match before they made it a street fight. I thought they could do the first ever Hell in a Cell. Well, they could save it for WrestleMania weekend. But I think that's how that story plays out to its conclusion. The story should end with the hero, Johnny Gargano, winning back his fans. You let some time go by. He comes back. He finally wins the big one. But I do think they need to put some daylight between these two for a while before revisiting it. All right, we're going to wrap things up here. I want to get this thing up as quickly as I can here before SummerSlam, since we have predictions here and the pay-per-view. Well, it's 1 o'clock now. The pay-per-view may already be on the air for all I know. It may have started an hour ago. But we'll get this up now here for you. We'll get back to the mailbag and Lucha and all the usual stuff next week. This is a packed show as it was, 2 hours, and I didn't even get to any of that stuff. But thank you to everybody who I saw this weekend, whether it was at the House of Glory show or our own meetup yesterday at the KBH. You are all awesome. Thank you so much for making this such a fun weekend. If you are one of the many that I talked to who are going to SummerSlam today, my prayers are with you. Good luck. It's going to be a very long night. Hopefully the show is worth it in the end. Hey, you know, sometimes all it takes is one big elaborate swerve at the end of the show to get people talking and to walk out of there buzzing. It could happen. It could happen. I'm going to be watching from the comfort of my own home and recording a review for the YouTube channel, so watch for that early tomorrow morning. Follow me on Twitter, as always, at Solomonster. I'll be live tweeting during the show. Follow me on Instagram. My name on there is The Solomonster. I'm trying to, I guess it wouldn't be tweeting, it would be gramming. I'm trying to gram more on Instagram, if that's a word, I don't know. But in any event, thank you again. I will be back for episode 561 next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, and enjoy SummerSlam for those of you tuning in, and I will see you on the YouTube channel for the SummerSlam post-show tomorrow morning. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God.
What do they think this is, Shakespeare?
I was driving yesterday, and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane.
I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope, and we could fade to commercial.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.